You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth. You want answers? You can't handle the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Welcome to the Student Union, everyone. I'm your host, the Chancellor, Pastor Marcus Zill. Great to have you here with us in the Student Union on this beautiful fall day. Midterms are hopefully over for all of you students. It's a little nippy in the air. It's getting to be that time. Thanksgiving around the corner. Great to have you with us today as we take a look at a very important topic, something that's facing us on campus related to secularism and what we call the new atheism and its impact on our morality and ethics. But before I bring on our interviewee for the day, just a little bit of clip to set the stage.
So I see this double standard as a problem. And strangely, this is precisely the erosion of basic common sense that many religious people are worried about. I hope it'll be clear to you at the end of this hour that religion is not an answer to this problem. Okay, belief in God is not only unnecessary for a universal morality, it is itself a source of moral blindness.
And here to talk with us today about what we just heard and the implications of it is Sean Kilgo. Welcome, Sean.
Hi, Pastor Zill. How are you?
Hey, it is great to have you with us here in the Student Union. Sean is a seminary student, has his Master of Divinity, but is getting his STM degree, a Master of Sacred Theology, at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, and serving while he is doing so as the grad assistant in historical and systematic theology, and if I'm correct, serving as a part-time nose tackle for the Denver Broncos. Is that true? Are you really doing that? I don't remember you being quite that big.
It's almost true. But the guy who's actually there is Darius Kilgo, although I'm pretty sure he's not related. One, because he's like 6'4" and 300 pounds, and two, because I haven't seen any checks coming my way.
Okay. All right. Well, I just thought, I think we're both Bronco fans. Are we in Broncos fellowship here?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. So, and every time I see Kilgo, I think of Kilgo, come on, you know, get that guy. Anyways, it is great to have you with us today to tell everybody a little bit about what we're going to talk about. Maybe introduce yourself. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What is kind of your background?
We'll start with my background a little bit. I'm from Albuquerque, which is where you're at right now in the Student Union down there. And I grew up the land of the Zia, that's right. And the Roadrunners and the hot air balloons.
Absolutely.
So I grew up actually as an agnostic. I never went to church growing up. I tinkered with it a couple of times when there was a particular girl in high school that I thought I might like date, and so I'd go with them to church, but usually that lasted one Sunday, and that was about it. There wasn't any sort of talk about religion at all in my household. My parents are both very much stereotypical engineers, and so they kind of hold to this a similar sort of mindset that we're going to talk about with Sam Harris,
the clip that we just heard, one of the,
right,
the new atheists. So anyways, go ahead.
Right. But they are what you might call angry atheists. So I would say probably more agnostic. When I'm down in Albuquerque periodically, and I'll be at Grace, which is where Michelle, my wife, and I were confirmed.
That's my home church.
We'll preach there periodically. I'll preach there, and my parents will come and listen. So they're not opposed to it, but they don't pursue it at all either. It's not something really on their radar.
So you weren't an angry agnostic. You just were completely you were indifferent to it. Didn't see what difference it really made. You know, this whole God thing.
Right. And then I started going to church when I met my wife, and she told me she wouldn't date me unless I did. And now here I am a few years later studying to be a pastor in the church.
See, so, ladies, what kind of power you have over the guy folk to draw them. I tell people dating evangelism, I'm telling you.
Very true.
I've seen it so many times as a campus pastor. Ladies, take note. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, well, especially with girls, it seems guys will do just about anything. Girls, on the other hand, seem to be a little bit smarter than that. So,
girl power.
Exactly. So that was kind of my background growing up. I went to a secular school, University of New Mexico. Isn't known for being the most Christian. I can remember the time there, and it's been many years since then that it was pretty intolerant of religion while I was there. So I can only imagine what it's like today. This is one of the reasons actually why I've gotten interested in the whole apologetic task and dealing with morality and ethics being a part of that. We actually met recently this summer at the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. One of the things we talk about there is ethics and the grounding of ethics in revealed scripture.
Now, what is it? We had a great time in Strasbourg in last week's program. We had another young man, Noah Hahn, on that we left together in Strasbourg. And you and I actually met at the Concordia Apologetics Conference up in Concordia University, Wisconsin. That's going to happen again. They're going to have another one this coming March. So this area of apologetics is obviously a huge interest of yours. Is that what you're kind of studying in your STM?
I was initially. I actually did a little bit of a switch from my STM. I'm going to be writing in the area of ecclesiology. I'm working on the side of another master's degree that'll be done through the University of Strasbourg that's going to be in this area. And I have plans in the future to continue pursuing this both academically and practically and pastorally.
Excellent.
So it's definitely in the long term for me.
So what... When you hear that clip that we just heard coming from Sam Harris, what would you like to tackle in terms of talking about morality and ethics and values in this context of new atheism?
Okay, yeah. I think what will be helpful is to actually be concrete in this and talk about specifically Sam Harris and his work on this, because he kind of represents generally what new atheism will talk about.
So he's kind of the poster boy for this.
He is. A little note on this. I mentioned he's one of these what's called new atheists. They're similar to the old traditional atheists with a few tweaks. One is that they tend to attack what you might call weak or soft points of religion and Christianity. Like morality and ethics, and one of the ones you hear very commonly today, whether or not God is a just God or a mean God, these sorts of things. Instead of what you would get with some of the older guys in atheism, which are guys like Nietzsche, who would have attacked straight at the jugular of the core of Christianity, attack things like the cross and the incarnation and the emphasis on the weak, which is what Nietzsche does, for example, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. So there's a little bit of a shift, but then the other big thing that's unique about the new atheism is that they have a tendency to be extremely aggressive in the manner in which they approach debating and speaking against and writing against Christianity. It's not just proposing another viewpoint. It's actually trying to almost in a military fashion tear down any sense of religion, not just Christianity, but any sense of religion at all. They also, though, have a tendency to be spiritual. So, for example, Sam Harris writes a book in which the subtitle is "How I Am Spiritual Without Being Religious." So there's kind of an interesting remodeling of atheism with these guys.
And that seems to be a reoccurring theme whenever statistics come out from Gallup polls and whatnot. People are always expressing that people are more spiritual ever. They just aren't particularly religious.
Right. It is particularly a troubling trend, that the separation of religion and spirituality. And you can see where this can end up leading with these guys, the new atheists. Real quick, there's four guys that are considered the poster people, poster boys. I don't know if we can say boys, poster people of the new atheism. They're referred to actually as the four horsemen of the non-apocalypse, which is a title that's coined in a debate in 2010 that actually has all four of these guys there. And it's Richard Dawkins, which most people know that name, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, who died in 2011, and Sam Harris, who's by far the youngest. So Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett are both in their 70s. Christopher Hitchens died 2011 in his 60s, and Sam Harris right now is only 48. So he's by far the youngest, and I think that's part of the appeal of him to some of the younger groups, is he's this kind of young guy that's out there. He's not this old white guy that's doing this.
No, he's got the whole, he's got the, when you listen to him and watch him, he's got the whole package. He's got he's got the skinny jeans. He's got the camp shirt tucked out. He's got the, you know, but yet he is extremely intellectual at the same time.
Yes, he is. He holds a bachelor's in philosophy from Stanford and a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA. So he's very well educated. And he's one of the few guys actually that has a degree in philosophy, which makes him even more dangerous in discussions. For example, Richard Dawkins doesn't have a philosophy degree, even though he writes about philosophy. But Sam Harris does. And actually his PhD, is entitled "The Moral Landscape: How Science Could Determine Human Values," and that then translates into the book that he writes in 2010 with basically the same title, and that's what we're going to be focusing on today.
Now, did he have a religious upbringing?
Yeah, he did. He was born to a family that was his dad was a Quaker. And his mom was Jewish, although he stated that really there wasn't any talk about religion, and they never really went to church. So it was kind of a religion name only. Although it's interesting having that his mom is Jewish and that being an influence on him. Particularly when it comes to dealing with the aspect of the existence of hell, because for those that don't know who are listening, the Jewish religion doesn't really have a concept of hell as we understand in Christianity and most other religions. It's more, there's a rabbi who equates it to a washing machine. You put dirty socks in and they wash and they get clean, and then you go to, and they go in your sock drawer, and that's kind of what their idea of hell is. You go in and you get spun around in a washing machine for a while, and then you get to go into heaven. So there really isn't a conception of hell per se in Judaism. That, I think that probably has a big effect on how he thinks about a lot of these things.
So what is kind of his overall view regarding morality that he promotes in his books and when he speaks?
So the big thing that he's promoting is the ability of science, and he has kind of a loose definition of science. How science can determine for us objectively human well-being. That's how he likes to phrase it. He will use the language of ethics and morality, even though moral is in the title. He prefers the language of human well-being, and we'll talk some more about that in a minute. And then also that religion isn't able to give any sort of objective or reliable account for the basis of human well-being or values or ethics or any of these things. And then from what we heard in the clip, that belief in God is just entirely unnecessary for any of this. And then one of the other things, it's somewhat subtle in his writings, but it has a profound impact, and that's that he speaks about free will being an illusion. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
Well, he doesn't just say it's unnecessary. He's basically saying it's actually counterproductive to getting to well-being.
Yes, he does. Religion is, exactly.
And he holds everybody accountable. It's all religion, because he's gotten in trouble with the Christians as well as the with Muslims. It's equal opportunity for this guy.
And interestingly, he's also received quite a bit of blowback from many in the science community for calling them basically liberal secularists, which he does fairly frequently in his book. So
he's carved out quite a niche for himself. Then.
he's certainly equal opportunity when it comes to insulting people.
So what are some of the problems with his view, as you see it?
There's a lot. There's a lot to cover.
Well, we got about eight minutes, so let's see what we could do here.
So I would encourage, since we can't cover it all here, anybody who wants to know more about this, there's a great book that responds to this called What Makes Us Moral by Craig Hovey. There's also a debate that's online between Sam Harris and an apologist named William Lane Craig. However, if you go to watch that, I would highly encourage you to watch it with someone who's trained in either apologetics or ethics and morality, and can watch it with you, probably your pastor, so that they can help guide you through thinking about this stuff. Because Harris is incredibly seductive in the way that he presents something, but he's kind of like a Monet, the paintings. He's really appealing from a distance, but then when you get up close and you start looking at the brush strokes, you're not really quite as impressed with the arguments he's making. He makes a lot of semantic arguments and a lot of logical fallacies, and we'll talk about
it. And just so everybody knows, that that debate, I think it's 2011. With Professor Craig, it's a University of Notre Dame forum. It's got about 500,000 views. You can find it on YouTube if you plunk in Sam Harris debate. It'll come up pretty quick. Anyways, point well taken about, if you're going to watch it with a group, especially watch it with somebody that has kind of the background and training. Or invite Sean Gilgo to come and watch it with
you. Sure. I only charge a nominal fee.
Well played, seminarian Kilgo. Anyways, so some of the problems.
One of the big problems is how he will redefine things. In particular, in his setting up the definition of what well-being is, which is at the heart of his entire argument, he defines well-being alongside the defining of good. And he ends up redefining good basically to mean well-being. So he says this, if we define good as that which supports well-being, as I argue we must, the regress initiated by Moore's open question argument does really stop. And so what you end up getting is well-being in its own definition. So if you ask a question or make a statement, something along the lines of, isn't maximizing well-being good, a good thing, which he asks us constantly throughout his book, it's the same in the way he sets up the definition of saying, isn't maximizing well-being supporting their well-being, or isn't maximizing well-being maximizing one's well-being? So it's just a circular way of speaking. In fact, the sentences don't even really make sense. When you do the substitution of the words there, it's a huge problem, because then he's playing very fast and loose with the definitions, and he can say whatever he wants now, because he's defined the terms the way he wants them to be defined instead of the way they actually are defined.
And isn't the ultimate question Well, who gets to decide what is good? What is the foundation for,
right.
for whether you call it well-being or good? Who is to say?
Right. And this is where the argument keeps coming back to, or should come back to, if we're having this discussion with people, is where is the foundation? Where does this stuff originate? Who is to say that this is good and this is bad? Now, we should make the distinction that saying that, like, there isn't a God doesn't mean that there is no definition of good or bad. You can make those definitions, but there's no founding for the definitions. There's no foundation any longer for the concepts. Another one of the big issues that's in his book is he has this emphasis on the consciousness. So he speaks about consciousness and its importance for determining morality. So he says, for example, morality and values relate to facts about the well-being of conscious creatures. That's a quote from his book. And so there's a couple of questions that come up with this. Is what about the unconscious? That was one of the first questions I had. So someone who's in a coma or brain dead, and actually human embryos, he'll talk about this later on when it comes to embryonic stem cell research, that we don't need to worry about the ethics of that because these aren't, conscious creatures. So apparently consciousness doesn't happen until you're born. I'd ask, what happens if you're born, 2 months early? Are they conscious then? So there's a lot of questions you can ask there, but basically you end up with no morality regarding those who have no consciousness. And so we might as well just get rid of the baggage with this, which is a very, very sad way of viewing humanity. The other side of this, though, is what separates us as humans from other conscious animals, because throughout this, there's the emphasis on evolution, and that we're just simply evolved animals, and we've evolved to this state, and we have all these various things regarding morality that go into evolution that allow us to get to where we're at. And so, predators, you have a lion goes out and he kills a zebra, but we don't call that murder. You have a number of animals who will forcibly copulate, but we don't call that rape. A variety of animals that take other animals' food and things and homes, et cetera, but we don't call them thieves. And so the question is, why not? If we are simply animals, why are we setting up ourselves as being so much greater? And this is actually a thing called speciesism.
Just speciesism. So you know, we've got just about 2 minutes here left on the program. This is really fascinating. We can probably talk forever about this, and maybe we'll have you back again sometime and hone in on a certain topic related to this. But in your estimation, why do you think this is important? What for our college students out there especially, why do they need to be aware of this kind of these kind of arguments of the new atheists?
Well, probably the most obvious is so that they can know what sort of thing they're up against, how to respond to these sorts of things, the apologetic need, the immediate need. But long-term need, we really need people who are going to go into this field, who are good, faithful Christians, who are going to go and study philosophy and get advanced degrees in these fields and know this stuff really well so that they can go out and counteract some of this thinking, because if we don't counteract it, it's just going to go out there. Sam Harris's last 4 books have all been New York Times bestsellers, so people are reading this stuff. And if we don't give them something else to read and to listen to, then this is all they're going to get, and that's not good.
And we are seeing increasingly on our college campuses, all these universities have their religious study programs. Now we're seeing a proliferation of secular study programs because the secularists want to be able to have as if they don't have enough run of the mill opportunities on our colleges and universities. They also are offering secular studies programs, and so this is going to be hitting us up far as much more than we would like to think down the line as we become increasingly secularized. Any final thoughts? We just got about 20, 30 seconds here, and then we got to get rolling. But any final quick thoughts?
I guess my only thoughts would be, you know, encouragement for all those that are out there dealing with any of this to continue to be faithful to our Lord and to His Word, and remember His promises that as they despised Him, so they will also despise us. But also, as He has been resurrected and gone into heaven, so too will we be resurrected and be brought into our heavenly home.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you, Sean, for being with us. God's blessings on the remainder of your studies, and maybe we'll have you on again down the line.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Lord's blessing.
Yeah. Well, that's a wrap. God's blessings to all of you out there on campus, including all of our seminarians. Hey, you're in school too, right? Join us every week right here in the Student Union. And if you can't wait, don't forget that you can download all the archives of this program at KFUO.org. And remember, college is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help.
Hi. My name is Matt Zuschel, a junior at Lutheran High School North in St. Louis. It's hard for teens to stay firm in their faith as they go through high school. We certainly don't get much support from our culture, and it's tough for our parents and churches to do it alone. That's why I'm at a Lutheran school preparing me to succeed in college, serve as a Christian leader, and remain rock solid in my faith. Have you checked out Lutheran schools lately? Learn more at lhsnstl.org. lhsnstl.org.